Recently, some people have asked me what the Bible teaches about the subject of giving. And usually, if you ask me a question, an open-ended topic like that, such a broad topic, I'll usually respond by handing you a handful of tapes from some album and say, here, listen. I started to do that recently. Somebody asked me what I believe about giving and how he could think through the issue biblically. And I realized I couldn't do that because I didn't have any tapes on that. I've never preached on it. I've mentioned it a few times in some sermons here and there, but I've never really studied the topic. And then that troubled me a little bit because then I thought, well, I need to make sure that my giving is in line with all the major principles in Scripture about giving. And so I needed to study that. But I don't have time to study anything other than what I'm preaching. And so guess what you get to hear about for a while? This is what we're going to study. And this is a good time to do this. It's a good time to do a study on giving because people won't be as tempted to wonder about our motives. We're not in the middle of a building project or trying to raise funds for any specific thing right now. We're doing okay financially, as far as I know. We're paying our bills. Everything's okay. So I don't want you to think that I'm doing this because we are trying to get money from you. I just want to know what Scripture teaches, and I want you to know that. And so this is something that we should study. So before we go back to our study of Ephesians, we were working verse by verse through Ephesians and took a break for the summer. Before we jump back into that, I want to look at this topic this week and next, and we'll see how far into it we get. We'll begin with the Old Testament. We're going to look and just do an overview of the entire Old Testament, see what the biblical theology of giving in the Old Testament is. We'll start right at the beginning. If all you think of when you think of giving in the Old Testament is the what's commanded in the law and tithing and all that, you need to back up a few steps because giving goes way back, way earlier than the law of Moses. The first recorded giving in the Bible is in Genesis 4. Genesis 4 is the story of two people, the first two people born in this world, Cain and Abel. Verse 2 says, now Abel kept the flocks, and Cain worked out of the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to Yahweh. But Abel brought fat portions from the firstborn of his flock. Yahweh looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. And then Yahweh said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? So God has the opposite reaction to these two offerings. He looks with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. The word translated look with favor is just a word that means to look at, to gaze at, or to pay attention to something. It's the only place where it's ever used in relationship to an offering. Cain offered a gift, and God just didn't look at it. He didn't pay attention to it. He looked away. He ignored it and ignored Cain. Instead, he looked favorably on Abel's offering and on Abel. Now, what's the difference between the two offerings that caused this different response? Why did God look with favor on one and not the other? Some people have assumed it was because Abel offered a blood sacrifice, an animal, and Cain offered grain. But there's really no basis for assuming that. I know it's a traditional view, but grain offerings were perfectly acceptable to God. They were commanded in the Mosaic Law, Leviticus 2, and elsewhere. They're just as pleasing to God as any other kind of sacrifice. That idea has been the traditional view, but it's not, you should know, it's not endorsed by any major evangelical commentary on Genesis over the last several decades, and for good reason. Blood offerings were for atonement. That's the purpose of a blood offering, and there's no discussion of atonement in this passage at all. In fact, it doesn't even mention the blood. What it says is that he gave fat. It highlights the fat that he offered from the animal. And the text doesn't explicitly tell us why God favored the one and not the other. But if you look closely, I think there are some indications. There's two differences in these offerings. All Cain did was just bring the fruits of the soil. That's all it says. But Abel did more than just bring some animals. Verse 4 describes, Abel brought animals, but with two modifiers. Abel brought, number one, the fat portions from some of the firstborn of the flock. So that's the only indication in the text that's of any difference, but it's striking. I mean, it's noticeable. It jumps out at you. The fact that Cain just brought first fruits, or fruits. It doesn't say first fruits. It doesn't say any. It's the choice portions or anything. But for Abel, it says that it was the choicest portion. That's what the fat portion means. And that it was from among the firstborn. So that's what causes the difference in God's reaction. That's the only thing in the text that we can find that would be a difference. Worship involved, right off the bat, the very beginning, giving something of value to God. And the more valuable it was, the more it pleased God, the more pleasing it was. Cain's offering was ignored by God because it was common. It was just some of the crop. It cost him very little. It cost him something, but it was of some value, but it was not of supreme value. What makes an offering supremely valuable is two things: being the choicest and being among the first fruits. If you give God a sheep, he's not interested in an average sheep. He's not interested in a blemished, sick, diseased, weak sheep. He's not even interested in average sheep. He wants the pick of the flock, the choicest portion of the choicest sheep. And he doesn't want you to wait around and see if you have enough sheep to get by on and then offer him one after that. He wants not the last born, but the firstborn. Those are the kinds of things that make an offering valuable. Now, why? Why is that important to God? What does that matter to God? Is it because God needs slabs of fat? I mean, is God interested in fat? No. If God desired fat, he could create galaxies made out of lamb fat. I mean, if that's what he wanted. It's the actual fat itself is of no meaning whatsoever. And why the firstborn? Is God in a hurry? I mean, does he have bills he has to pay? He has to get this in quick? No. So what is it that make those two things important? Well, the answer is in Hebrews 11:4. I'll read it to you. It says, "By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offering." It was the faith that made the difference. It was the fact, you can sum up the difference between these two offerings in a single word, and that's faith. Giving God the first and the best pleases God because it's a mark of genuine faith, and faith is what's pleasing to God, Hebrews 11:6. You're not going to give God the first fruits unless you really trust him, right? You got to trust him or you won't do it. If you don't really trust God, there's no way you're going to get your paycheck, sit down, and your very first check you write out from your paycheck is going to be an offering. You're not going to do that because you're going to have to concern yourself with, well, what if God doesn't provide my needs? If you don't trust God, you got to worry about paying all your bills first. People who don't trust God will do that. They'll pay everything else first, and then they'll offer God whatever last fruits might be left over. So the principle here is what honors God is first fruit because that shows faith. And keep in mind, these principles have nothing to do with the Mosaic law at all. This is prior, way prior to the law. It's way before Moses. They're taught in Genesis 4 and reaffirmed in Hebrews 11. It's throughout Scripture from beginning to end. You'll see it everywhere. So there are universal principles that apply to all people in every age. And that's what I want you to pick up on. As we go through, just kind of pick up on each one of these principles that come out of all this and apply them to your heart when you think in terms of giving. One of the most important elements of worship is offering things to God, giving gifts to God. But in order for that to be acceptable, the offerings have to be special. They can't be common. That's what the word holy means, is special. You give something common to a human king, that's an insult for which you will likely be punished. If you give something common to God, that is a supreme insult. This principle is even true in dealing with equals. You give something common even to an equal, that says something. I mean, my ordination day, I still remember, it's a day I'll never forget my whole life. You were all so kind and affirming and encouraging. There was a fellowship meal and celebration, and I was given a very beautiful ordination certificate and all that. And I didn't ask for that, and I didn't expect all that. However, I have to say that if that day would have come and only half of you would have showed up and nobody really mentioned anything and my ordination certificate was scratched out on the back of a napkin, you know, or something, I would have gotten a message, right? This is not all that important to these people. Now, if that's true of me, I'm just a human being. I'm just a regular person. To offer God something common sends that same message. We're just not all that interested in this. And God would prefer no worship at all to that kind of so-called worship. Notice also that in both cases with Cain and Abel, God's reaction to the man was identical to his reaction to the offering. You notice that? Whatever God thinks of Cain, Cain's offering, he thinks of Cain. Same thing with Abel. Whatever God thinks of your offerings reflect what God thinks of you. It's kind of a startling thought. So the Bible starts out with three chapters on how things got the way they are, Genesis 1 through 3. Then chapter 4 begins the story of humanity. And the very first thing that happens is that people come and give something of value to God as an offering. The first thing that's discussed about life on earth is the giving of gifts to God. And it's interesting because Cain's an unbeliever. Cain is the prototype of lost humanity. And Abel is the prototype of saved humanity. And both make an offering. But the only one that's accepted is the one that's offered in earnest. So from the very first pages of the Bible, God teaches us the difference between worship that brings him pleasure and worship that does not bring him pleasure and that he does not have any regard for. That's how it starts out. And then you can track through and just see offerings, just spontaneous offerings, just offered to God. People just do that. That's just part of life on earth. That's what Noah did after the flood. He just made an offering. No record that God commanded that or anything. Now, if you're going to give something to God, that's part of life on earth. That's just an essential part of life. You're going to be giving God gifts. First question is about your motivation and your attitude, and that's addressed right away with Cain and Abel. Another question that obviously is going to come up is the amount. How much are you going to give? And we're first introduced to the amount given in Genesis 14, where we see the word tithe for the first time. So turn to Genesis 14. The word tithe in Hebrew and in Greek and in English all mean the same thing. One tenth. That's what the word means, a tenth. Sometimes people use the word tithe to refer to any offering that you put in the offering plate. That's not really accurate. A tithe is 10%. Just means 10%. If you write out a check for 18% of your paycheck and put it in the offering plate, that's not a tithe. That's a tithe and 8%. Okay? You put 5% in there, that's a half a tithe. The tithe just means 10%. And tithing was very, very common in the ancient world among all people, and we first are introduced to it in the Bible in Genesis 14. Genesis 14, what's happening are some invading armies are coming to attack and defeat a city where Abraham's nephew lives, Lot. Lot was living in Sodom, and Sodom and Gomorrah get attacked and lose. And so now Lot is taken captive, and carried away, and his family. Well, when Abraham hears about that, he's not going to stand for that. He springs into action, and in his household, he had trained 318 guys to fight. And they were evidently well-trained. He gathers those 318 guys up and takes off to hunt down this group of five armies that had attacked Sodom and Gomorrah. And he catches up to them, attacks them, and clobbers them. Just routs them, and brings back Lot and his family, as well as all the other people, and a lot of spoils of war, a lot of money. And immediately upon returning, this is what happened. Look at verse 18. Genesis 14, 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, and he was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram. This is before Abram's name was changed to Abraham. He blessed Abram. Now, this is the first priest we ever see in the Bible, and he's not a Jewish priest, obviously, because there's no such thing as Jews. This is during Abraham's life, so there's no such thing as a Jew, but he's a priest. Even before the existence of Israel, even before the law, even before there was such a thing as the Aaronic priesthood of Israel, there were priests. There's at least one priest, a man whom God had appointed to represent him to men. An intermediary. And when he comes back, when Abraham comes back from this great victory, he encounters this priest. In verse 20, it says, then Abram gave him, the priest, a tenth of everything, a tithe. He just gave it. spontaneously as an offering. Then he took the remaining 90% and gave it all back to the king of Sodom. He didn't take any of it. It's interesting. He tithed. He wanted to give it back to the original owners, but first he tithed on it. And there's still no record that God ever commanded a tithe or any offering, and it doesn't look like any kind of regular thing. It's just a one-time spontaneous act of worship. And again, it's of the first fruits. You see that same thing. Before he does anything else, he gives 10% to God's representative. Now that's a good tithe. Turn to Genesis 28. We'll see another tithe. The next one isn't such a great tithe. Abraham gives us a good example of how to properly give to God. Jacob comes along then in chapter 28 and gives us an example of how not to give to God. This takes place right after Jacob's dream about the ladder that goes up to heaven. Genesis 28, verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and watch over me all this journey that I'm taking, then I will and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I may return safely to my father's house, then Yahweh will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all that you give me, I will give you a tenth, a tithe." Now, if you know the story of Jacob, you know at this point he has given absolutely no indication of being a believer at this point. His character is nothing but bad. He just scams to try and work deals to come out ahead, and this is just another one of those deals. I believe his conversion happens most likely four chapters later when he wrestles with the angel. But at this point, he's still just as conniving as ever. God has shown him mercy, God has shown him grace, and in response he says, "Okay, God, here are my demands. You watch over me, you protect me, you give me food, you give me clothes, you make my journey successful, you comply with all that, and then I'll give you 10%. And I'll start to worship you." Jacob will worship God and give to God, but only if God gives all the blessings Jacob demands up front. It's completely backwards. Every single thing in what Jacob is saying here is just completely reverse of what it should be. He's the type of so-called worshiper who will freely give to God only after God provides a certain amount of security and success. Opposite of giving your first fruits. He wants God to give him first fruits. God has a whole lot of work to do on Jacob still before Jacob's going to be useful for anything. And four chapters and a dislocated hip later, he's finally ready to worship God unconditionally, which is the kind of worship God will accept. So giving 10% to honor God out of faith is good. Giving 10% to get God to give you what you want is bad. Then comes the law. Now let's take a look at the law real quick. We never see a tithe or an offering commanded until the Mosaic law. We see it offered, but we don't see it commanded. There are three passages in the law about the tithe, Leviticus 27, Numbers 18, and Deuteronomy 14. Now, you don't have to turn to all those, and I'm not going to study through all those. By the time you get to the period of the just before the birth of Christ, that 400 years prior to Christ, they call that the intertestamental period because it's in between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. In that in-between time, by then, the Jews had understood these three chapters as referring to three different tithes. So the Jews taught at that time that you have to give 30%. You have to get three different tithes, and they said that because there are some differences in these tithe commands in these three chapters. And I'm not going to take the time to go through all that. I'll just give you one example of the differences. In Leviticus, the tithe is supposed to support the Levites and priests. And in Deuteronomy, you bring the tithe and you eat it. You eat from your own tithe. And so that's why they thought they got to be different tithes. But most likely they're just one tithe that's commanded, and those apparent differences can be explained other ways. They're not real differences. When Deuteronomy tells the people to eat from their own tithe, the tithe from their own crops, it doesn't mean eat it all. It's just a single meal as part of the ceremony. But the very next verse, even in the Deuteronomy 14 passage, it says, and do not, right after it tells them to eat their tithe, it says, and do not neglect the Levites, living in your towns, for they have no allotment or inheritance for their own. When God gave the promised land to Israel, he divided it up among all the tribes except one. There's one tribe he didn't give anything to. That's the tribe of Levi. They didn't get anything, and they couldn't do anything to earn a living either because they had to work full-time in service of God in ministry. And so God instituted a tithe to support them. Everybody gives 10%, and that goes to support the Levites and the priests. And every third year, it was also used to support the poor. And that was the purpose of the tithe that was commanded in the law, to support the full-time workers in the ministry. Now, turn to Leviticus 22. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Third book. Chapter 22. There's many, many, many different kinds of offerings in the law. I mentioned the tithe, but that's just one of many. There's all kinds of different fellowship offerings and wave offerings and guilt offerings and all kinds of offerings. I just want to highlight one that I think is very intriguing, and that is the free will offering. Leviticus 22 introduces us to the free will offering. Now, this was an offering that was, it's called the free will offering because it's not obligated in any way. It's when you give something that's just not required in any way, not even by a vow. If you make a vow that you're going to give something, then that's not a free will offering anymore, because the moment you make the vow, then you're obligated to give it. A free will offering has to be an offering given with no obligation at all. You just want to spontaneously just express love to God, and you do it. And it's a beautiful thing to say. I love reading through the Old Testament and reading about these free will offerings when God regulates them. You know, he gives a law and says, by the way, when you give me a free will offering, do this, 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 and this. And I like that because what it tells you is obviously it was happening, right? I don't know what you think about Old Testament people. If they're just, you know, legalists who are just going through and following rules and they don't have any sense of closeness, intimacy with God, that's not the case. We see Israel, we see their hearts, and when it comes to the free will offering, they were very exuberant about it. It wasn't commanded. They just wanted to give. They just wanted to bless God with something they had. That's the heart of a true believer, whether you're in Genesis or Deuteronomy or Romans or anywhere. So they're given free will offerings, and it's regulated in Leviticus 22. And you might assume that if an offering is a free will offering, and if it's just something that's given on top of everything else, after you've done everything God has commanded, and then this is just extra, then it wouldn't matter what you give, right? Because it's just extra. It's just a bonus. I mean, if somebody owes you $50 and they pay you the whole $50 and then they say, I want to give you some extra. Well, you don't have any requirements about how much the extra has to be, right? It's whatever they give. And you might assume that would be the case of a free will offering, but it's not. Look at Leviticus 22, verse 17. It says, if any of you, either an Israelite or an alien living in Israel, presents a gift for a burnt offering to Yahweh, either to fulfill a vow or as a free will offering, you must present a male without defect from the cattle, sheep, or goats in order that it may be accepted on your behalf. Do not bring anything with a defect, because it will not be accepted on your behalf. Verse 22, do not offer to Yahweh the blind, the injured, or the maimed, or anything with warts or festering or running sores. And verse 23 goes on to say that the standards for free will giving aren't quite as high as those for the required offerings. Verse 23, he says, you may, however, present as a free will offering an ox or a sheep that is enlarged or stunted. So let's analyze that for a minute. The required offerings had to be without any kind of flaw. They couldn't be stunted or enlarged. They couldn't have any flaw of any kind. They'd be perfect, because the whole point of them is to serve as a picture of what? Christ. Christ's sacrifice. And if they're going to be a picture of that, it's essential that they be perfect without any kind of flaw. However, the free will offering had a different purpose. Purpose isn't so much to illustrate Jesus' sacrifice on the cross as much as serving as a picture of just spontaneous worship. And so since it wasn't a picture of Christ's sacrifice, it didn't have to be absolutely, completely perfect. However, the major thrust of the chapter is that it still had to be close to perfect. If it had any serious flaws in it, it would not be accepted. And God says, don't offer it. I'd rather you give nothing. And that's an important principle that reflects just the same thing we saw with Cain and Abel. It is better to offer God nothing than to offer him something second rate, even in a free will offering. In fact, you might assume that the free will offering could be any amount that you want, but that's not entirely true either. Deuteronomy 16:10 says this: celebrate the Feast of Weeks to Yahweh, your God, by giving him a free will offering in proportion to the blessings Yahweh, your God, has given you, and rejoice before Yahweh, your God. You see, a free will offering could not just be any amount. It had to be some amount that is in proportion to the amount that God had blessed you, the blessings you've been given by God. Giving God a gift that is out of proportion with the way that he's blessed you is not acceptable. Not only that, but if you gave a free will offering with the wrong motive, that was not accessible. Not only was that not acceptable, it was a serious sin. Listen to the sarcasm in Amos. I'll just read you from Amos 4. As God rebukes the people for giving with the motive of taking pride in their giving. Okay, this is what God thinks of that. Amos 4:4. Go to Bethel and sin. Go to Gilgal and sin even more. Bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes every 3 years. Burn leavened bread as a thank offering and brag about your free will offerings. Boast about them, you Israelites, for this is what you love to do, declares Sovereign Yahweh. The rebuke is in the sarcasm. A free will offering that you boast about, you give for pride purposes, is abhorrent to God. Now, let me show you something really interesting. Turn to Exodus 35. And this is just, I love this. God's commanding the building of the tabernacle here. He wants it built. He requires that they build it. And so in Exodus 35, they begin the fundraising drive to build the tabernacle. They've got to come up with the money because God's requiring a lot of really expensive things in there. So verse 5. Look at verse 5. Everyone who is willing, mark that, who is willing, has to be a free will thing. Everyone who is willing to bring to Yahweh an offering of gold, silver, or bronze, blue, purple, scarlet yarn, fine linen, goat hair, ram skins, dyed red hides of sea cows, acacia wood. He just keeps on listing all the various elements, things, materials that are going to be needed for the things that he's commanding. Then verse 10, he talks about labor. All who are skilled among you are to come and make everything Yahweh has commanded. I want you guys to build it, those who have skills. So the gifts, sometimes the gifts were money, sometimes they're materials, sometimes they're service and skill. Verse 21, and everyone who was willing, there that is again, and whose heart moved him. Everyone who was willing and whose heart moved him came and brought an offering to Yahweh for the work of the tent of meeting, for all its service, and for the sacred garments. And all who were willing, men and women alike, came and brought gold, jewelry of all kinds, brooches, earrings, rings, and ornaments. Nothing is said about those who weren't willing. They're not rebuked. Nothing is said about them at all. The focus is on those who are willing. And they brought all this stuff. Verse 26, and all the women who were willing and who had skills spun the goat hair. Verse 29, all the Israelite men and women who were willing brought to Yahweh free will offerings for all the work Yahweh, through Moses, had commanded them to do. Look at chapter 36, verse 2. Then Moses summoned Bezalel and Oholiab and every skilled person to whom Yahweh had given ability and who was willing to come and to do the work. And they received from Moses all the offerings the Israelites had brought to carry out the work of constructing the sanctuary. And the people continued to bring free will offerings morning after morning. And so all the skilled craftsmen who were doing all the work of the sanctuary left their work and said to Moses, the people are bringing more than enough for doing the work Yahweh commanded to be done. Moses, we've got a problem. Too much money. Now, I think there's a couple of fascinating things about this. First of all, the fact that service is viewed exactly the same as financial giving. And then number two, no individual was ever required to give anything. However, God commanded that everything be given and all the work be done. Isn't that interesting? No individual had to give, but somebody had to give. It was totally voluntary, but it was required that the end result be that everything be given. God wanted His magnificent tabernacle to be built, and He wanted the money and the labor to come from the people, but it absolutely had to be out of the desire of their heart. So 8 times in this one section, He repeats the fact that they have to be willing. They have to be willing. They have to be willing. Free will. He wanted the tabernacle to be especially holy, and evidently it would be more holy if it were built out of the sincere desires of the people's heart rather than out of just mere compliance to a command. You get that? The building is more holy if it's built out of the free will offerings of the people instead of just compliance to a command. That's what it means in the New Testament when it talks about God being pleased by a cheerful giver. He's not at all pleased if you just give like Cain. What pleases God is if you delight in giving to Him. It's not just the giving, it's the taking delight in giving to Him. And that delight is usually reflected in your gift. You can tell if somebody takes delight in giving to God by just looking at their gift, right? And what a delight it must have been to God when these people responded this way. They come up with all this money and service, not only enough to build this amazing tabernacle, but ended up with more than enough in verse 5. 1,000 years later, we see the same thing. We turn to Ezra. This is just a few books before Job. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, and then Psalms. Ezra chapter 1. The Jews found themselves in captivity, and their temple was destroyed. Then came Cyrus, the pagan king that God used to rescue His people. Cyrus defeated Babylon and then sent the Jews back home. So you can go back home, and you can. And not only that, he decided to rebuild the temple. And so in Ezra 1:4, look at verse 4, he says to the Jews, basically he says, anyone who is willing, and you see that same thing again, anyone who's willing, go back and rebuild the temple, and it will be paid for by the free will offerings. Verse 5, then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, exact same phrase as before for the tabernacle, they all prepared to go up and build the house of Yahweh in Jerusalem. All their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, with the valuable gifts, in addition to all the free will offerings. And God kept track. He kept careful track of how much was given. He even recorded the amounts in Scripture. Over in chapter 2, verse 68. It says, when they arrived at the house of Yahweh in Jerusalem, some of the heads of the families gave freewill offerings according to the rebuilding, toward the rebuilding of the house of God on its site. According to their ability, they gave, there's that again, according to their ability, they gave to the treasury for this work 61,000 drachmas of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priestly garments. So they recorded the amounts. And we won't go all through Ezra, but at least a half a dozen times through Ezra, everywhere you look in the book of Ezra, you're going to find that this was free will offerings, free will offerings. It was all built through free will offerings. So, let's summarize all that. So far, from the very beginning of humanity, we see that giving to God is an integral part of human life. And those gifts are accepted or rejected by God based on the attitude of the giver. And the level of faith. When the Mosaic Law came, God required many, many different offerings of the people, the tithe, countless other sacrifices, but the concept of free will giving still remained an important part of worship throughout the time of the law. So that's pre-law and then during the law. Now let's look at one more thing. Wisdom literature. The wisdom literature in the Bible are those books devoted to teaching us how to live a skillful life, how to make good, sound decisions in life. So they're books like Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, and Job, and some of the Psalms. And what they do is they teach you the way life tends to go, the way this world tends to operate so that you can make wise decisions. Those books say a lot about giving. They say a lot about money. People always ask, you know, how how do I know what God's guidance for me is in an area not addressed in the Bible? Like, what job should I take? Where should I move? What school should I go to? Things like that, where there's no Bible verse that tells you what to do. And the answer is, you apply the decision-making principles of wisdom, the wisdom literature in the Bible, and if you do that, God promises to lead you through life where He wants you to go. You understand that? That's how you know God's will for your life. You don't get a feeling, you don't get a sense, you don't get a prompting, you don't get some kind of a message. You just follow the wisdom literature of Scripture. That's what God has commanded. And since so much of life on earth has to do with money, the wisdom literature has a lot to say about money, because so many of our decisions have to do with valuable things. Proverbs breaks it down into two categories, attitudes and actions. I'll just go through this real quickly. The attitude, if you want to be wise when it comes to money, the first thing is to understand the value of money. First of all, money is very valuable. You might hear warnings about overvaluing money, and that's in there too. That's important. But it's also foolish to undervalue money. Money is important. You don't understand how valuable money is and how important money is, you're going to make foolish decisions in life. There are a lot of troubles in life that money can protect you from, such as injustice or discrimination. What Proverbs 13 and 19 talk about. Money can put you in a position of great influence over people. Money is powerful, especially in the hands of the wise. So it's important. It's valuable. On the one hand. On the other hand, the value of money is limited. It can protect you, but it can't protect you from everything. Money is deceptive. It gives you a false sense of security, Proverbs 18:11. Whoever trusts in his riches will fall. There are a lot of things money can protect you from, but if you start looking to money as your source of security, brace yourself because you will fall. One way or another, God is going to have to teach you that it's wrong. It's a wrong source of security. Looking to money as your security is idolatry. And so we have all these warnings throughout Proverbs. Money has no effect on a person's value. It's not connected with intelligence. It is not as valuable as peaceful relationships. It is not as valuable as righteousness or justice or godly speech. It's not as valuable as wisdom or understanding or truthfulness or humility or a good name or respect. It's not as valuable as, but easier to get than a prudent wife. Proverbs 19:14. So you say, I've got a prudent wife and she's costing me thousands. Well, it's still a good deal. Not only are there limits to the value of money, but there are some real drawbacks to wealth that can drive you to do wrong. Chapter 28, verse 21. It makes you a target. It tends to make you proud. So you understand all these principles. And when you understand all those principles, number one, it's going to tend to cause you to have wise decisions about money. And number two, it's going to help you have the right attitudes about money, such as contentment and generosity and giving instead of stinginess and all that kind of thing. The whole issue of contentment is a big deal in Proverbs. Greed is a big deal. Greed is desire minus contentment. That's what greed is. And when you choose to set a large percentage of your thoughts on what you don't have, that's greed and covetousness. In Proverbs 28:25, greed is the opposite of trusting God. God says that He's kind. He's given proof that He's kind. He has flooded you with kindness, and greed is a refusal to believe in that, to accept that. That God is kind. Greed says, I have to grab as much as I can possibly grab. I have to generate all my own happiness. I have to hold on to it because God's never going to provide it. I have to get my hands on way more than I need because God's not going to take care of me in the future. So understanding that is going to protect you from greed, which in turn will protect you from stinginess. Proverbs 11:24. One man gives freely, yet gains even more. Another one withholds unduly, but comes to poverty. A generous man will prosper. He who refreshes others will himself be refreshed. And by the way, I'm just zooming over this. This is an overview. If you want to look at these principles in depth, you can get the Making Wise Decisions tape album, the study through Proverbs, and go through that. This is just to kind of refresh your memory. There are two different kinds of money in Proverbs. Proverbs tells us there are two different kinds of money. One is valuable, the other is worthless. Some dollar bills are worth more than other dollar bills. Proverbs 10:22 says, the blessing of Yahweh brings wealth and He adds no trouble to it. That's the good kind of wealth. Proverbs 15:6 says, the house of the righteous contains great treasure, but the income of the wicked brings them trouble. That's the bad kind of money. You don't want that kind, the kind that brings you trouble. The good kind brings life, the bad kind brings punishment. The good kind results in wealth, the bad kind has trouble added. The good kind will still be around when you are old and you will give it to your kids. The bad kind will end up in the hands of a stranger. The bad kind dwindles away, the good kind multiplies. It's better to have 10 that will multiply into 1,000 than to have 10,000 that's going to dwindle down to 100, right? Obviously, you don't want to have the bad dollars. Punishment is added to them, you end up losing it. You'd have to be crazy, though, not to want the good kind. So, what determines the kind of money that you get? Three things determine whether you get the good kind or bad kind. Number one, your method of getting it. Proverbs 10:2, ill-gotten treasures are of no value. Now, ill-gotten treasures, that includes money that you get through fraud, through lying, through stealing, through oppressing the poor, through giving gifts to the rich, and through exorbitant interest, charging people too much interest. Money gained through those kinds of means doesn't have the buying power that the good money has. God will see to it that it'll turn bad in your wallet. Proverbs 20:17, food gained by fraud tastes sweet to a man, but he ends up with a mouthful of gravel. Proverbs 21:6, fortune made by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and a deadly snare. Bad money is fleeting. It just goes away. Somebody once said, if money could talk, it would say goodbye. That's true of bad money, but it's not true of the good kind of money. God will see to it that your bills will increase if you have the bad kind. Your car is going to break down, your furnace will go out, whatever, something's going to happen and the money will be gone. Your wealth is not determined by how much money you have, but it's determined by how much you have in relationship to your expenses, and guess who's in charge of your expenses? God is. So, the illustration I gave you before, if two guys need a refrigerator, say the first guy earns $100 through honest work, and he goes shopping for a refrigerator. He happens to find a great deal that's, you know, it's $500 or $200 instead of $500. And on the way home, he gets the mail, and there's an unexpected refund check from an insurance company or something like that. And so he goes away. He ends up with a great refrigerator that lasts for years, and he pockets the extra couple $100. Now another man uses shady techniques and swindles somebody out of $1,000. And he goes shopping for a refrigerator and on the way picks up his mail, and in his mail is an unexpected bill for $1,500. And so he has to borrow to get the refrigerator, he has to pay full price, he gets home, the day after the warranty is up, it dies. So, you tell me which is more valuable, the 100 good dollars or the 1,000 bad dollars? See what I mean? You can't discern how much money you have unless you know if there is the good kind or the bad kind. And that's determined by how you get it. So, if you remember back to elementary school, greater than, less than, $100 plus God's blessing is greater than $1,000 with trouble added. So, number one, the method of getting it determines whether it's good or bad. Number two, your character determines whether it's good or bad. Your character determines the value of your wages. Righteous people get paid a different kind of money than unrighteous people. Proverbs 10:16. The wages of the righteous, that's the good kind, brings them life, but the income of the wicked brings them punishment. So a righteous man's paycheck for $1,000 is greater than a wicked man's paycheck for $1,000. And then the third thing that determines the value is wisdom. The wiser you are, the more useful your money is. Proverbs 17:16, of what use is the money in the hand of a fool? So, you need to get the good kind. Say, how do I get the good kind? You want money? You want good, valuable money? The book of Proverbs gives five ways that you can gain money, gain wealth. Not only gain wealth, but gain the good, valuable kind of wealth. Five ways to get money. Five things you can do that will tend to result in God prospering you financially. And those five things we discovered in our study of Proverbs in that Making Wise Decision tape album. So if you want to know what those five things are, all you have to do is listen through tape 22B or 23. I think it's labeled 23. And there in the back, they're just three easy payments of $29.95. No, you can just take them. But we're not going to talk about that right now because that's kind of beside the point. I told you Proverbs teaches two things about money, the right attitude and the right actions. Let's just talk quickly about the actions. What to do with your money. It's no surprise Proverbs has plenty to say about how to manage money properly. a lot of it's common sense. It tells you don't squander it, don't have an expensive lifestyle, don't give foolishly to people, don't mismanage your money. But even more important than the money you have is the money you give. And the number one thing Proverbs teaches to do with your money is this. If you want to be wise, if you want to do well financially, the wisest thing you can do with your money is, Proverbs 3:9, honor the Lord with it. Proverbs 3:9, honor Yahweh with your wealth, with your first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing and your vats will brim over with new wine. Honor the Lord with it. How do you honor the Lord with it? The word honor is almost always associated with giving. And once again, we see that the way to honor God is by giving the first fruits. Honor God with all your first fruits, with all your increase. So, suppose you have all good money and no bad money in your bank. That good money is divided into two categories, the first fruits and all the rest. And the only money that's useful for honoring God initially is the first fruits. You give to God first, which demonstrates faith and priorities. God will not accept leftovers as worship. When you pay all your bills, you do whatever you want to do, and then you give, that doesn't honor God. Kindness to the poor also honors God, Proverbs 14:31, and will be rewarded by God. Proverbs 19:17 says, if you do that, you give to the poor, you're lending to God. You'll be rewarded. I'm sorry, Proverbs 28:27 says, no, it doesn't say it either. One of those verses says it. Anyway, Proverbs 19:17 says, he who is kind to the poor, oh yeah, there it is. He who is kind to the poor lends to Yahweh, and he will reward him for what he has done. So, let's just see if we can gather all that up. Very often people look at the Old Testament teaching on giving, and all they see is the tithe. That's all they can see. But the tithe was such a tiny, teeny, tiny little part of what the Old Testament teaches about giving. Now, next Sunday, we're going to talk about whether or not the tithe is relevant for us today in our giving. But for now, let's make sure we don't miss the clear principles from the Old Testament about that are timeless, that apply to every age, to every person in every age. And by my count, I spotted 10 of them. Maybe you saw some others, but here's the 10. Let's just review these and then we'll be done. Number one, a major component of life on earth is giving to God. If that's not a big part of your life is incomplete. All of human life is either receiving from God or giving back to God. It's hard for me to think of anything. I can't think of anything in life that doesn't fit into one of those two categories. Everything in life is either receiving something from God or giving back to God, right? So that's a major component of life. Number two, the acceptability of an offering is determined by the motives in the heart of the giver. The only gifts that God will accept are those that express true worship inspired by genuine faith. Number three, when an offering is given out of faith, that can be seen in the nature of the offering. You can tell by looking at the offering whether it was given in faith, because it'll be the choicest of what you have. It's not your leftover time, but your best time. It's not your leftover money, but your first fruits. It's not your leftover energy, but it's your best energy in service to God. In order for a gift to honor God, it must be something of great value to you. If you offer God something of little value to you or something that is common, that dishonors God and is not acceptable worship. Remember what David said, I will not give to God that which costs me nothing. Somebody wanted to donate a sacrifice for the king to offer a sacrifice. He said, I'm not going to accept that as a donation. I'm going to pay you for it because I will not offer to God that which costs me nothing. Number four, the way God thinks about your offerings is the same as the way God thinks about you. Just like Cain and Abel. Number five, God is highly honored through free will giving, so much so that certain things He would not allow to be financed through any other means. It had to be through free will giving. A building built through free will giving brings God more honor than one built through compulsory giving. Number six, the tithe has always been a valid way to express love and honor to God, but it offered only if offered with the right attitude. Number seven, whether or not your gift is a tithe, it must be in proportion to the amount God has blessed you. You understand that? It's got to be some percentage of your income. Whether it's 10 or not is another issue, but it has to be some percentage. So when you give, it shouldn't be in terms of amounts. It should be in terms of percentage of your income. Number eight, service offered to God is exactly the same as money offered to God. Number nine, God does not require free will giving, but He does expect it. He does not command it, or it wouldn't be free will giving, but he does expect it. The tabernacle had to be built, but only through free will giving. Number 10, the person who is wise with money, the real financial wizard, is someone who honors God with his first fruits and who is generous with those in need. And God repeatedly promises reward for financial reward for people like that. Okay, so now there's a whole lot of other questions I know. What about giving to get? If God promises to reward me if I give, and I give to get that reward, isn't that the wrong motive for giving? Giving to get money? And what significance does the tithe have for us today, and how much should I give, and how do I determine what's the right amount to give to the church, and what's the right amount to give to the poor, and what's the right amount to give to missions, and all that? Those are some of the things that we'll talk about next time. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we are so grateful for the bounty and the richness of everything you've given us. You have showered us with such blessing, so much. Everything is yours. And Lord, when we give to you, it's just a token. At the most, it's just a token because you already own everything anyway. And yet, Lord, we long to give those tokens because we do want to express our love for you. We can't give you something you need, but we can give something that's precious to us just to express the zeal in our hearts for your glory. Father, as we give in a moment, we give our offering. As people are walking out, they put their offering in the plate and so on. I pray that we would fulfill these principles in doing that, that it wouldn't just be a money in a plate where we're trying to pitch in to pay for utilities or something like that, but it would be real worship with all these motives so that none of it dishonors you. Lord, I pray that there wouldn't be a dime that gets put in that plate today that would dishonor you. This is our desire, Father. We pray this in your holy name. Amen.